My name is Joel Peterson. I'm the moderator of this discussion. This is the first Sunstone Theological Symposium that I've attended, and I've had a lot of feelings as I've attended these last 3 days here. I think probably awe is the one that I feel the most right now, that so many people could spend a Saturday afternoon here listening to three Texans talk about ethics in business when their alternatives are to listen to discussions of sex just up the hall. And some of the people that are here aren't even related, I don't believe. So this is an awe-inspiring thing. I must admit that I'm also a Texan, not by birth, but I got there as soon as I could. Let me introduce our three panelists this afternoon. Each of them will present some ideas for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll have some time to ask questions. Bill Johnson will be speaking to us. He has a PhD from Harvard in econ, spent 7 years with the Rand Corporation, 23 months with Bill Simon working in the government. He was in the Council of Economic Advisors, worked in the Treasury and in the Energy Administration. For 3 years, he was a research professor at George Washington University and has spent 7 years as chief economist at Tenneco, and also as an adjunct professor or as a part-time professor at Rice University. Max Pitcher will also address us. He's from Alberta, Canada, got bachelor's and master's degrees in geology from BYU and a PhD from Columbia. He has since been at Conoco for the past 20 years. He's been a bishop two times, seminary teacher, and has five kids. And his wife is one of the people in the audience. Roy Bennion is the third person who will address us. Roy received his MBA from Harvard in 1972, and unlike most MBAs, has stayed with the same company that he started with. Wolf Morgan, who is a competitor of mine in Houston, Texas, and a worthy one. He's been a partner there since 1976, serves as the chief operating officer of that company. They do mostly office parks and investment, real estate investments there. He's the father of four children, and his wife Molly is another of the people here in the audience. We'll go in the order of Roy first, who will address us on the general framework of ethics in business, and particularly orient his comments towards ethics in the small business where the owners are the same as the managers. Then Max will address us discussing ethics in oil and gas. I asked him if there was such a thing as ethics in oil and gas, and he reminded me that I'm in the real estate business and had no right to ask that question. And then finally Bill will address us on the ethics of the large corporation where the ownership and the management are separate, and discuss executive stewardship, and then we'll try to leave about 20 minutes at the end for any questions.
My willingness to share thoughts with you today comes from a general concern about the ethical condition of business in America today, in our society, and the lack of ethical standards that we frequently encounter. I'm not an expert on this subject. I just have to deal with it all the time. I have a particular responsibility, I think, as a member of the church, to apply a Christ-like pattern of ethics and morality to my business dealings and with my fellow man. Although I do not think that the Mormon concept of this responsibility, at least as practiced in the business community, is particularly more developed than any other religions that I have encountered. I think that's too bad, but I haven't experienced differently. And so my comments, in some respect, are as much of a warning as they are an invitation for all of us to aggressively pursue high ethical standards. My perspective is hopefully somewhat different than the two other panelists, both of whom I know and have a great deal of respect for. I'm a businessman engaged in a small, personally oriented business. It is as mentioned, land development, business park, and office park development, as well as land investment in Houston. I have two other partners. It's both senior to me in the company, and we have 13 employees, up from one when I joined the firm a little over 12 years ago. So it's a small business. We've been very successful. We currently control in excess of $200 million of net worth in properties in the Houston area. And while that number is not important, I wish to establish a framework for my remarks. We're not a large corporation, but we deal with very large personal and company wealth, as well as large personal risk, and can be under immense pressure from that side of it. The company, in many respects, however, is run for our own convenience. It's disturbing to me that most people presume that business executives are not ethical. There was a Gallup poll conducted a little less than a year ago and published in the Wall Street Journal about this issue. The general public, the poll reported, found that only 18%, the general public believed that only 18% of business executives deal ethically on a consistent basis. Of course, they didn't have a very good opinion of most everybody, but they rated doctors as 53% ethical, and lawyers, for heaven's sakes, as 24% ethical. Only congressmen were rated lower, at 14%. While most executives gave their peer group a higher rating, all of them felt that they were under considerable ethical pressure. Nearly 4 in 10 said that they had been told by their superiors at one time or another to commit deeds that were unethical. Concerns seem to be particularly high in the areas of product claims, kickbacks to suppliers or customers, and taxes. Both the general public and business ethics businessmen assumed that other businessmen cheated on their taxes. Most people believe that executives used photocopy machines for personal use, overstated their job qualifications and their past salaries when they were looking for a job, padded their expense reports, and accepted expensive gifts from suppliers. Ironically, the same study posed a hypothetical question to both the general public and business executives on an ethical issue, and the business executives responded with far higher ethical concern than the general public. How do you explain this dilemma? Well, the article didn't, but I believe that difference might be explained because the business executives do deal with ethical issues on an ongoing basis, while perhaps they don't feel that they can respond to them ethically. Since that article appeared, there's been a lot of other business press about ethical issues. In fact, you cannot pick up a general business publication today without reading something along that line, particularly in the order of hostile corporate takeovers, green mail, golden parachutes are terms that are used. We've recently seen the takeover attempts or successful takeovers of Gulf Oil, Bendix, Martin Marietta, Getty Oil, Disney, Carter Hawley Stores, and so on. Their executives set up deals where if they failed in the takeover fight, they'd have a massive payoff, making them instantly wealthy. Or conversely, the rating company was paid off a massive overvalue in the stock it held to get rid of them, to get them to cease the takeover bid. In both cases, stockholders' equity is diluted, the company incurs additional debt, it often sells off productive divisions, and there's not one new job created, no new products brought to the marketplace, no productivity for the nation is raised. You'd have to consider the whole process a waste. As stated on the front page of last week's New York Times business section, many people are alarmed that America's corporate chiefs are losing sight of moral standards in a new frenzy to get rich. Well, I'll leave the corporate side to Max and Bill. Suffice it to say that I think ethical standards are under severe challenge. Perhaps the major difference I perceive between my kind of business, which is small and personally oriented, and the corporate one, is that we are much less structured. We're governed by very little policy. We're small and non-union. There's no hiring manual, no defined standards. Job descriptions are personally fit to the people that we hire. There's no order of regular advancement within the company. Sometimes I wish there were. When we have qualified people, it'd be handy if there's an opening that occurs on a periodic basis. We have no stockholders to answer to. We just answer to ourselves, the three principles. Therefore, we can pursue business opportunities and spend money as we please. And we're not bound by the security and exchange laws. We only have one authority that we really have to pay any attention to at all in that sense, and that's the federal tax code. And because in a complicated business such as ours, there are many areas of gray, we can pursue a very aggressive stance there. However, we don't pursue illegal ones. Notwithstanding the lack of structure, we do have some very strong common objectives. We wish to be profitable. We want to have a quality product and a quality life within our company for our employees. We wish to have a lasting impact through improving the environment for the people who live in our parks and those who work there. These things can only come if there's first a sense of direction and personal responsibility at the company level. This can be done, although it is more difficult, without a common sense of religious or ethical standards. Religiously, my partners are raised Catholic but agnostic and Reformed Jew. We don't have a common set of principles that bind us together. However, as chief operating officer of our company, much of that ethical interface with employees in the outside world is upon my shoulders. I'd like to discuss those things in two categories, kind of the external problems and the external ones. I believe that buyer beware is a good motto. However, it's much better if the buyer that you're working with is someone you know who's an ethical person. We make representations constantly in our business. We have project brochures, we deal with appraisals, consultants' reports, engineers' reports, all of them attesting in one form or another to a project's soundness or its economic viability. And I have learned that appraisers and consultants can be hired to say just about anything you want them to say. And I'll give you an example where it's an issue that we have faced both over the past and recently. In 1981, we entered into contract by putting up $500,000 to buy a 415-acre property in Houston. We had 6 months to close the deal. When we closed, we had to raise $13 million in cash. We planned the property as a master planned office park, and we hired a master planning firm immediately and went to work with them and developed the master plan. Upon its completion, we hired a nationally recognized appraiser to give us an estimate of the value of the sites that we would have when the development work was completed. They estimated that the value of the sites would be $63 million when completed. We used that plan and the appraisal then to go sell options on $21 million worth of land. With that in hand, still during the six-month period, we approached several commercial banks and were successful in arranging $30 million of project financing to do the development work and carry the project through its completion, which was estimated to be over an eight-year period. By design, we only developed the northern half of the property. I think we engaged in this process honestly, and we did it ethically. Now we are faced with what to do with the southern half. Original appraisal. We also appraised the southern half of the property as if it could be developed in the same manner. And in fact, when we started development on the project, we anticipated that we would do it in the same manner, that is, as an office park. Conditions in our marketplace, however, have changed radically. There are currently 32 million square feet of unleased office space in Houston. That makes for bad times for office park developers. There's not a high demand for sites when there are empty buildings sitting all over the place. So we looked at what to do with the southern half of the property and decided that the logical approach, since it's a beautifully wooded tract of land, would be to develop it into a townhouse and apartment sites, as well as some retail and service center locations. I don't think that was part of my program. We still had the appraisal, in fact it's current as of January 1, 1984, stating that the sites on that property are worth $43 million. I know it's not worth that. We could, I believe, go to a commercial bank and arrange close to $30 million of project financing. Because we are a strong company in our marketplace, we could do that with relatively little liability on the loan. A maximum, I would guess, of 20%. Now, to put the numbers together, that means that theoretically, we could take our $43 million appraisal, borrow $31 million, pay off an underlying $7 million debt, do $3 million worth of development work, and pocket $21 million. If we then defaulted on the loan, we'd have $6 million worth of liability to pay off, and we could walk away from the thing $15 million in our pocket. No further liability, no further obligations, only the knowledge that we have behaved unethically. Now, sometimes that happens in spite of your best intentions, but in this case, I know the property is not worth that. Fortunately, I have a partner that agrees with my ethical standards on this subject, and we're going to have the property reappraised downward. It's painful to do that sometimes, but I like the deal under the framework of the fact that we're going to be in business a long time, and I don't want somebody to do something like that to me, and it's wrong. So we changed the numbers. I talked to my vice president of finance about that. He's a young fellow who is very bright and very ambitious. In the past, he's been an accountant and a consultant with a Big Eight accounting firm, and for the past 2 years prior to our hiring him, was a securities attorney in Houston. He said that in his experience, lawyers and accountants that he worked with lie for their clients every day. If the proposal is possible, then he says they can make it look credible. Clearly not all consultants or attorneys or accountants are dishonest, but they are realistic. If they don't give favorable rulings to the people who hire them, then they aren't going to get hired again. It's not the law that we're talking about here, because they wouldn't openly break the law. It's their ethical standards. Representations must be ethical. That's both a statement and a warning. As you perhaps evaluate proposals that are sent to you, remember that perhaps the best way is to approach them is with the truth being worth a grain of salt, and then go from there. I bargain for a living. It's fun, and it's challenging, and it's exciting, but ethics are a major part of it. If you say your property is worth $1.50 a square foot, knowing very well that you're willing to sell it at a dollar, how do you reconcile that ethically? I go into negotiations usually with 8 or 10 things that I say are important principles, knowing full well that I'm ready to give away 6 of them. Also knowing that the guy on the other side has a feeling that he wants to accomplish something through the process of negotiation and isn't about to go back to his people and say, I accomplished nothing. So you go in knowing that part of the game is having the give and take on what you are representing. I think that's all right, but again, you have to keep in mind the subject or the concept of, are you doing something ethical? Would you like that person to do what you're doing to him in reverse? Let me speak one other real estate-related ethical situation that I think we'll read a lot about in the next 2 or 3 years, and it's quite a concern. Most of us remember the financial fiascos caused by the REITs in the past. I think we're about to see the same thing happen with savings and loan institutions. SNLs historically lent money on the basis of buying money from the general public, for those of us in the room, out of our passbook savings accounts. So they paid us very little. Then in turn, they turned around and made long-term, relatively inexpensive home mortgages, 30 years, 6-8% type mortgages. When high inflation came along and volatile interest rates, it blew that system apart. SNLs now can only buy money at current market rates. Now in today's market, probably in the 12% range. They can only buy it for very short time periods, 60, 90, 180 days, sometimes a year in a certificate of deposit. They rent it back out very often, though, still for 5, 7, and 10-year times on home mortgages. This creates a real problem for them. Their earnings are squeezed, and they have to find another source of income. Well, they've found a way, and it doesn't sound very good to me. They have entered into massively, on a countrywide basis, joint ventures with investors and real estate developers. Both parties are acting, in a sense, in a con game, in my opinion, although not illegally. The SNL says to the investor, I'll put up all the money for you. You do the work. I don't have that expertise. You do the work. I'll charge you a nice fat interest rate, maybe 15%. And I, however, as the project is completed, will take 50 to 70% of the equity in it. In return, I'll only charge you in current interest, say 10%, and we'll accrue that last 5% to the end of the project. When it's sold, we'll get it back. However, the SNL books that interest as current income, so it looks really good on the balance sheet. Their income statements look good, stock prices go up, executives get raises, everybody gets a pat on the back. The underlying assumption there, of course, is that the project will appreciate in value a compounded rate of 15% a year. And in many of the overbuilt markets that exist around the country today, that just isn't going to happen. And so 1, 2, 3, and 5 years out from now, a lot of those things are going to start going back. Now let's look at the developer side. What is he doing? Well, he doesn't have the money to go get convincing, so he goes to the SNL and says, I have an appraisal here. It shows that if I could borrow 80% of the value of the property, that I could make a success out of this project. Coincidentally, that 80% value is likely to be 100% of the dollars that are needed. So that man puts no money into it. In fact, he'll charge a development fee or a management fee, which gives him walking around money, pays his office overhead, supports him in a living, buys the car, etc. Has no recourse. So when the project starts to fail, he says to the SNL, here's the deed. You're on your own. The SNL doesn't know how to manage a project, so they sell it under distress. Who's out? Well, there's a big loss for the stockholders later on. If the SNL fails, it's a big loss for the taxpayers, because then the FSLIC has to step in and rescue the association. So there are a lot of losers under that circumstance. And I think an awful lot of that is going to happen. In West Houston alone, in the last 24 months, I suspect that there's been in excess of $1 billion of projects started under those kind of conditions. And it's happening in most of the markets around the country. It is unethical behavior when you approach it from the standards of knowing that you're probably going to fail, but you're supporting your short-term goals in the meantime, and you're doing it at the expense of someone else. We're fortunate in Houston in that we don't have a lot of regulatory authorities to deal with, so bribery's never been an issue with our company, but I know in a lot of other marketplaces, bribes to zoning people, to get building permits and so on are commonplace. Another ethical issue to look at. I mentioned in the beginning the necessity of a company having a framework to deal with problems, ethical problems. Individuals are not often strong enough to alone buck the system, but an organization that supports strong individuals can be. The problems must be discussed openly. Policy needs to be as clear as possible. When the heat comes on, and it's a very time-sensitive situation, you very often don't have time to fall back and assess it and talk it over. We have staff meeting every Monday morning when these kind of issues are discussed. We discuss our representation of the market, our advertising policy, our negotiating posture, political support of candidates, and so on. Sometimes we're in violent disagreement one with another, but a lot of good comes from discussing these issues. Support of ethical decisions is imperative, so I continually raise them. As a Mormon and one who is openly so, I'm watched carefully. There are people in our market who will do business with me who won't even do business with my partners. Although, when they're dealing with me, they don't realize that my partner's in the background and we're discussing everything anyway. And we are in concert. How important it is, then, that LDS people act ethically. It's not necessarily that it's more important that we act ethically than others, but since we hold ourselves out to be ethical, it's important. Insurmountable damage can be done when we leave our religion at home or in the church building. In Houston, since we've been there in 12 years, one of our past bishops pled nolo on a felony insurance fraud charge. One of his partners and an attorney is still on high council. Our past state president for 6 or 8 years was convicted of a felony and disbarred. He was an attorney. One of the just recent members of the state presidency was sued by our company because they defaulted on a contract and failed to clean up a site after they had walked a lease. If I see it, I'm sure others do as well. Does the church go far enough when it merely asks an individual, "Are you honest in your business dealings?" And the answer comes out, "Yes." I suspect, at least in the examples given, that it was not sufficient. As trite as it sounds, I've found that still asking myself when I'm dealing with people, how would Christ approach it, is a pretty good system to rely upon. What would Christ do? Of course, one of the answers he might give is he'd get out of the land development business, or he wouldn't be an attorney. However, putting that aside, I think it's still a very useful tool to have at your disposal. You have to set up an organization or any group that you're being to deal with ethical issues if they're going to deal with them successfully, at least a high percentage of the time. That means you set up a framework. You have regular discussions. You decide what kind of policy you'll have if you are confronted with certain kinds of issues. And then you review what happens, because you learn a lot from your past mistakes. If our people in our organization are informed, then I think there's a much higher probability that they will act ethically. Thank you very much.
I've lived in Houston for 10 years and didn't know all that was going on. I'll have to be more careful in my next real estate businesses. 2 weeks ago, John DeLorean walked out of the courtroom acquitted of drug charges. The jury freed him because they felt he had been entrapped. The question was not if DeLorean was guilty. He was videotaped. It was called entrapment if DeLorean makes a drug deal with the government. The jury, would the jury call it entrapment if DeLorean made a deal with a Colombian drug dealer? The point is, DeLorean would not have been entrapped by the FBI or anyone else if he had high ethical standards. Business ethics is a complex subject. I can't cover all the different aspects of the topic, but I can talk about my experiences. The part of the business world I'm familiar with is the oil and gas business. In exploration for oil and gas, the areas most often requiring ethical decision-making are 1. Handling of confidential data, 2. Making deals with other companies. In these areas, the maintenance of trust, honesty, and integrity are very important. It may surprise some people when I say you don't have to be dishonest to succeed in business. In fact, it has been my experience that in dealing with people in my company, other companies, the government, and the general public, maintaining a high level of integrity is a key criterion for success. In my career, I have never felt the need to be dishonest, nor have I been pressured to be unethical. In my business, you can be censured or terminated for various reasons: incompetence, technical incompetence, insubordination, failure to perform, etc. But there is nothing that will more rapidly disqualify you than dishonesty or a breach of integrity. I'm not going to tell you there aren't dishonest people in the oil business. We have our share. and we try to avoid doing business with them. I do want to emphasize, though, that you can be honest and successful. In fact, a reputation for honesty, fairness, and integrity gives a person and his company a competitive advantage. In the oil business, landmen negotiate most of the trades to drill wells. It is common knowledge that a landman is as good as his word. Many deals are made in a barroom on the back of a paper napkin and guaranteed with a handshake. Of course, details may need to be negotiated later, and a formal contract will be signed, but the business often proceeds on the informal agreement. Here is an example. We usually have partners with other companies as we bid for leases offshore in the federal waters. Bidding is by sealed bid, and there is no way to be sure of making a winning bid. Companies often overbid the nearest bidder by millions of dollars. We always have a bidding agreement contract with our bidding partners. At one sale, we were planning a bid of $40 million with a company in an offshore tract in the Gulf of Mexico. On the eve of the sale, we received data of a well in the next tract. The data were questionable. The other company thought it was good. We thought it was poor. The other company's people and those of us from Conoco met in a hotel room in New Orleans the night before the sale. And I said, we're out of that bid. They said they were still in for $40 million. The landman from the other company wanted to get it in writing and get a new contract signed that night. But the other company's vice president said, if Max Pitcher says Conoco is out, then they're out. I have his word. Of course, the paperwork followed several days later. I met this week with a partner who had invested $10 million with Conoco, the president of 7-Eleven stores. He reminded me that the reason he invested with Conoco was that he had done business with us before, and to quote him, we were good folks. He also reminded me that he had spent several hundred thousand dollars before he had, quote, signed paper one. Later this week, I met with people from another department within Conoco, and they reminded me of the integrity that is required for some of their people to operate. They commit over the phone several million dollars, and the paperwork follows several days later. To quote one of these people, we only get one chance to mess up, and if the trust is breached, then people won't do business with us again. Unquote. There is no room for deceit or mistrust on anyone's part. When it comes to trade secrets, the oil business is not much different from other technical industries, such as electronics, aerospace, pharmaceuticals, etc. Oil exploration runs on new deals, ideas, and proprietary data that would compromise a competitive advantage if it fell into the hands of a competitor. We have a lot of secrets in our business. We work with confidential data daily. There is no way that you can write a contract that will cover all contingencies. A partner in a contract expects the spirit of the contract to be kept, even though the letter of the contract may not spell out a particular situation. We have a policy of not keeping any confidential data in our files unless we have documentation of how it was obtained. We are very careful when we review data on a proposed deal brought to us by another company. We make it clear to the other party at the outset that we are active in the area and we do not want to restrict our exploration activity in that area. Here is a rather blatant example of a violation of those principles. Conoco has a large natural gas field in South Texas. One day, a geologist working for another company came into our office and offered to trade us a large amount of confidential data that would have been very useful to us in exploring South Texas. We asked him if he had authority to make the trade, and he said he had local authority. As we talked, it became more obvious that this fellow wanted to sell for $100,000 his company's trade secrets. We said no thanks and made a phone call to their head office after he left. Most of the time, we don't have problems with this, but sometimes when our technical people leave to work for other companies, they take confidential data with them or use ideas they generated when employed by Conoco. We monitor this type of theft of trade secrets carefully. If the former employee or his new company starts buying leases in a specific area that the employee worked for us, we go talk to them. We do what we must to protect company assets. By far, most of our people are honest and straightforward, but we don't leave it to chance. We have a published ethics policy. We make sure our people understand it, and the policy receives strong support at all levels. As a reminder, once a year, anyone privy to proprietary information must submit a statement listing potential conflicts of interest and declare their compliance with the ethics policy. A company ethics policy is no guarantee of ethical behavior on the part of employees. Strong management support for the policy is important. Conoco's policy states, quote, "The intent of the company is that its employees maintain the highest ethical standards in their conduct of company affairs," unquote. It covers several broad categories in detail, such as giving of gifts, entertainment, receiving of gifts, conflict of interest, inside information, political contributions, and accounting standards. Guidelines under these categories follow common themes. Comply with all laws. Activity should be consistent with customary business practices. Public disclosure of the facts should embarrass neither the company nor the employee. Avoid conflict of personal and company interest, and keep records and proper documentation. I quote the policy again. The essence of this policy is that each employee will conduct the company's business with integrity, in compliance with applicable laws, and in a manner that excludes considerations of personal advantage. Neither ill-advised overzealousness nor failure to seek timely advice or counsel will be accepted as an excuse, unquote. I'm reminded of a sign in Rocky Mountain National Park that I often see that says, "Be familiar with the laws. Ignorance is no excuse." We encourage our technical people to be active in their professional societies, all of which have their own ethical standards. This includes rules against issuing false information, even though directed to do so by an employer. That reminds me of a deal we made with a small company a few years ago. They were to drill a well on our acreage within 90 days in exchange for an interest on our acreage. After numerous extensions to the contract time, we gave them one last extension. A week before the contract expired, we started getting daily drilling reports of the progress of the well. A week or two passed, and one of our landmen was out buying leases in the area. As he finished his work, he drove by the well location to visit the operator. To his surprise, there was no rig, not even a drilling pad. The daily drilling reports were a complete fabrication. Watch out for self-deception. Most people don't spend much of their business day thinking about ethics, and that makes it easy for unethical situations to occur. Here's an example. In South America, several years ago, we were operating, and we hired a local attorney. He was well-educated, an outstanding citizen, had a good reputation, and a good business reputation. His work was excellent, and we developed a friendly working relationship with this man. On completion of his services, he casually mentioned that he'd like to be paid in U.S. dollars in his Florida bank account. He was trying to avoid taxes in his country. We told him we couldn't do that, so he suggested his Arizona bank account. Surely there would be no problem, as other American clients had paid him that way on several occasions. We told him that we would pay him in his country's currency. The obvious theft of trade secrets and falsification of records are black and white situations that don't test our ethics or our judgment. And I've been involved in several. Some of those have been with the FBI, some key people we've had to release. And the temptation is great, but there's no question that those people are released. It is the gray areas requiring quick decisions that are tough and a true test of our ethical decision-making ability. I'd like to close with some guidelines, criteria for making ethical decisions when faced with a gray area. Ask yourself the following questions. How did we get there? Who benefits? Who gets hurt? What values do those who benefit and those who lose share in common? Where is your loyalty? Whom would you tell about your decision? Your family, the local newspaper, and what is the symbolic significance of what you do? This week I was negotiating with Metropolitan Life in New York. We have a multi-million dollar deal with them. I told them several years ago that I wouldn't tolerate technical incompetence nor unethical behavior on our part. Of course, we had a lengthy contract that followed, but I have to think that over the years we've done business with them, as one example, because of those behaviors. I'm happy to be involved in an industry that challenges my technical ability and expects and rewards high ethical standards. Thank you.
I feel like I'm surrounded by some sort of demonic spirits playing music and pounding tables and all that. As Roy indicated, I'm going to restrict my comments pretty much to the larger corporations. Tenneco, Conoco are among the largest corporations in the United States. Unlike Roy's company, which is very much a small owner-operated type company. For this reason, I'm going to also focus my concerns to the characteristic of most larger corporations not shared by many of the smaller ones, namely the separation of ownership from control or shareholders from the management. I know of very few actual instances where there has been outright criminal activity and illegality committed by companies. The very fact that when this does happen, it makes headlines, I think suggests its relative rarity. However, I think there are many instances of gray areas, cases where actions of questionable integrity have occurred, particularly with respect to the shareholders. I think we tend to think of the large corporations hurting the workers of America. Well, I think the workers are quite adequately protected by legislation, by unions, by other institutions that have developed over time. We also tend to think of consumers being hurt by the larger corporations, yet consumers do have recourse, again, to government regulation, government protection, as well as the courts. But unlike the workers and consumers, I think the great unprotected group of people in our country are the shareholders. Not only are they double taxed by the government through first the income tax, or the corporate income tax, and then the tax on dividends and capital gains, but also I think there's a third tax that tends to crop up in many corporations, namely a tax by management. Not long ago, about 2 years ago to be exact, I gave a lecture at the Executive MBA program at the University of Houston. For those of you who may not know, Executive MBA programs have as their students young executives, typically upcoming executives in companies, and they spend at the University of Houston Fridays and Saturdays being trained in the Executive MBA program. And I happen to raise with this class in the Socratic style that I much prefer to lecturing as I'm doing now, I raise the question, what is it that management is most concerned about? Is management really concerned about maximizing the shareholders' return? The result was a total and complete surprise to me. Like prairie fire around the class, one student after another got up to talk about some of the things that they had seen in their companies, which had involved basically the violation of shareholder rights, the ignoring, the almost willful ignoring of shareholder rights. One person got up and talked about how his particular boss had used company assets to repair his home. Another got up and talked about something I'm going to talk about in a second, a golden parachute that had been received by an executive, by several executives in the company. After the class, one of the students pulled me aside and said, I want to talk to you about something that's happened in my company. And he went on to talk about how he knew an individual who had abused, he thought, his company's standards should be held, particularly abused the shareholders' wealth, by basically misusing company assets, by using company assets to do some repairs on his home, maintenance of his home, and also abuse of the corporate plane. He went on to say, to make matters worse, this person hides behind his religion. He's a Mormon, and he doesn't cease letting people know it. That sentence just struck me right here, because it was the sort of thing that I hate to see members of my church be held up to ridicule for. And it was a reminder to me of how exposed we are as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to having to uphold standards that we should all be concerned with. In particular, in talking about the separation of ownership from control, I want to talk about several ways which I think recently have become all too common for, in effect, expropriating, taking away the asset value of the owners of capital, namely the shareholders. Executive compensation has to be made public under law, and once a year, Forbes and Business Week publish annual reports indicating not only the salaries and bonuses, but the total compensation of executives. This total compensation, including in addition to salaries and bonuses, benefits, and certain types of long-term compensation, such as amounts expensed for deferred compensation and stock gains, primarily on stock options. Just to give you some idea of the payments that go to the chief executive officers of some of the companies, in 1983, the leader was William S. Anderson of NCR, who earned $13.2 million. In 1982, it was Frederick Smith of American Express, who earned $51.5 million. and in 1981, Stephen Warner of Warner Communications with $22.6 million. These are very substantial forms of compensation. Some would argue that they are deserved, that these executives have indeed done service for their shareholders. Perhaps so. We'll talk about that in a moment. The median total compensation for these executives for some 291 firms in 1983, incidentally, was $452,000. Not that large by industry standards. I think the totals that I gave are very much the exception. But even more, I think, revealing is the increase in executives' total compensation. Of 269 firms, I gave you the wrong number a second ago, the 269 companies in Business Week's their most recent survey for 1983, top executives' pay rose by 13.1%. The inflation rate in 1983 was measured by the GNP price deflator was only 3.8%. So you had roughly about a 9% real growth in executive compensation. That's over and above inflation. The average salaries of workers in the United States incidentally increased by only 4.3% in 1983. Who paid for this substantial increase in executive compensation over and above inflation? It was the shareholders. It was the shareholders' assets that were being used to make that compensation. There are also other forms of compensation that are not included in these statistics. One company that I know has an Air Force with a 727 to fly its executives around various parts of the globe. Commonly used, I might add, to allow one executive to attend golf matches, golf tournaments in various parts of the country. Another company in Houston, headquartered in Houston, has a corporate art collection valued at over $1 million. The chief executive officer of that company happens to be an art collector, enjoys collecting art, and has something of a reputation for being an amateur artist himself. I recently had the privilege of attending the open house for the new office of that company and noticed that some of the more expensive pieces of art were in the executive office, and in particular his office suite, not surprisingly. There have been also other forms of use of company resources for personal use. I know of an instance, for example, where a tractor went to one executive's office for ranch for free, and instances, as I indicated a moment ago, of use of company assets for repair and maintenance of homes. Who pays for this? It's the shareholders. Another form of use of shareholders' monies that I think is questionable, although many people would not think so, is the support of pet charities. For example, why should a shareholder located in Salt Lake City give up his dividends in order to support the Houston Opera? But if you do that, if you are invested in certain companies that happen to be headquartered in Houston, that's exactly what would happen. In many cases, these charities are used by those people arranging the contributions as pet projects. It may be a contribution to a university. It may be a contribution to physical or athletic events. But nonetheless, why should the corporate office decide who's to get the monies? Why can't the shareholders decide for themselves? I think this is a very major question of ethics. The latest in executive compensation, which Roy Bennion referred to briefly, is the so-called green mail, also something called the golden parachute. Let's talk about the golden parachute first. The golden parachute was designed to protect top management in the event of being fired, especially now with so many mergers and acquisitions being taking place. Usually the golden parachute, which is a very substantial payment to the executive if he is fired, if he is laid off, or if he resigns, that golden parachute can be exercised at the discretion of the executive himself. There is a certain irony in this because mergers and acquisitions that we've seen so commonly recently reflect the undervalued stock prices of a number of the corporations being acquired. It's become a lot easier to purchase these companies. Yet, in turn, as I'm going to argue in a moment, these undervalued prices reflect, at least in part, poor management on the part of the very executives who are feel now the necessity of getting golden parachute for themselves. Let me give some examples of some recent golden parachutes. Conoco's chairman, Ralph Bailey, got a golden parachute for $637,716 per year several years ago until 1989. And that parachute was received 2 months before DuPont bought Conoco out. Another example this year was a golden parachute received by James Lee, who's chief executive officer of Gulf Oil. Gulf, as you may know, was acquired by SoCal, Standard California, or Chevron. James Lee got an $11 million golden parachute after taxes, just prior to Gulf's acquisition of SoCal. In addition, 400 other Gulf executives got golden parachutes ranging from about, I think it's $400,000 and up. This institution, if you will, the golden parachute, in effect, not only guarantees the employment of the top executives of companies that are being acquired, but it also, at the same time, guarantees them a minimum income, usually for the rest of their working lives. And who pays for it? It's the shareholders who are ending up paying for it. As Roy indicated, it's a form of dilution of their value of their stock. There have been other devices that have been adopted for protecting management's position in the event of mergers and acquisitions. Some companies, to protect against possible hostile takeover, have sold off their most profitable assets. Seems contrary to intuition that a manager would do that to his shareholders, but it has been done, and the primary reason has not been to protect shareholders, but to protect management's position and to ward off this hostile takeover. Another tactic is the acquisition of dogs. Unprofitable operations. Again, you wonder why the management would do this, other than it's, again, trying to protect its own position and not necessarily the interests of shareholders. You might find examples of what Roy referred to as green mail. A good example of this is the buyout of potential acquirers of companies. Earlier this year, you may recall that Coastal Corporation, under Oscar Wyatt, tried to acquire Houston Natural Gas, an interstate gas transmission company in the state of Texas. The result was a very determined effort by H&G's then management to ward off this acquisition. In the end, it was able to do so by offering Oscar Wyatt a profit of $42 million to cease attempting to acquire it, but the same offer was not extended to H&G's other shareholders. In effect, this was again dilution of shareholders' equity. Who pays for it? The shareholders do. Recently, responding to increasing concerns about golden parachutes and other forms of executive compensation, particularly golden parachutes, the U.S. Congress passed a law that makes a parachute above certain levels non-deductible to the company, and also requires the executive to pay a 20% excise tax on his parachute. I doubt if this legislation will be effective, because the executive that is determined to fill his own pockets at the expense of his shareholders will still take his parachute, letting the shareholders pay the additional taxes. Hence, James Lee's golden parachute at Gulf was after taxes, something he worked out with Chevron specifically to avoid this legislation. Have corporate executives earned these pennies, as they're called in the business? I think in some cases they probably have. There are instances where corporate executives have done very substantial service to their shareholders. Oftentimes, the example that is given, and I had it thrown at me recently when I talked to the High Priest Quorum about this very issue as a trial run a few weeks ago, often the example that is given is that of Lee Iacocca. No question about it. A recent Business Week article ranked the top executives, and I might add the lowest, the top 10 executives and the lowest 10 executives, according to whether they have returned their company's payments to them. And Lee Iacocca was at the top of the list. As chairman of the board of Chrysler, there's no question that the performance of Chrysler has improved. One of the reasons for it, however, has been the general improvement in the automobile industry. Last year was the best year ever in the history of the automobile industry. But another big reason is the fact that Lee Iacocca was able to get a very substantial loan guarantee from the U.S. government that effectively lowered interest rates that Chrysler had to pay and also made it possible for Chrysler to have access to capital. I question whether we as Mormons should applaud such behavior. Well, maybe Chrysler's shareholders should. Yet at the same time, what if we as Mormons applaud this behavior, there would be an element of inconsistency. It is contrary to the Mormon Church's policy to have individuals in need of welfare assistance to go to the state. I don't quite understand why we should applaud corporations in need of assistance going to the state as well. In general, most studies that have looked at the question of whether there is any relationship between executive compensation and performance for shareholders have come up with the same conclusion. I can list about three or four studies that have indicated this. And that is that there is no discernible relationship, or if there is, it is an extremely weak relationship between the level of compensation and performance for shareholders. What is more, those studies that have looked at these two factors have come to the conclusion that the two have performed very differently over the last decade or so. In 1982, Forbes did an analysis in which it concluded that adjusting for inflation, this is dividing through by some form of deflator, that executive compensation had risen by over 100% during the previous 10 years. That's 100% free and clear of inflation. In other words, the real value of executive compensation more than doubled over a 10-year period, whereas the total return to shareholders, also adjusted for inflation, fell by 30% over the same period. And this was for some 250 companies in the country. The return to shareholders fell, first because of the decrease in share prices, in both absolute and nominal and deflated terms, as well as inadequate levels of dividends. In effect, shareholders have had their assets pared away, chipped away, over a period of time. The performance of the Dow Jones Index is informative. In June 1984, it averaged 1,121. It broke, you may recall, 1,000 in November of 1982. At the time, there was great expectation that we would see a prolonged bull market, yet the performance since then has really been quite lackluster. What is more, the Dow Jones Index broke 1,000 in November 1972, 12 years ago, and 10 years before the last time it went over 1,000. In fact, in November of 1972, it was 1,000 on average, 1,001.19 to be exact. If you were to look at, if you were to convert the Dow Jones Index in June 1984, which is the last monthly average I happen to have available conveniently, and you were to convert that to fourth quarter 1972 prices, then the Dow Jones Index was really 541.45, to be exact. In other words, adjusting for inflation, investors have lost nearly half of their wealth, their investment in stocks over the last 10 years, or the last 12 years, to be exact. The Dow Jones has not kept up with inflation. It's been, in fact, one of the very poorest inflation hedges that we've had in this country. If you were to include dividends, this would lessen this loss to about 30% already mentioned. Something else that people maybe forget is that in December 1968, the Dow Jones Index came very close to going over 1,000 again. And if you were to convert the June 1984 Dow Jones Index to fourth quarter 1968 prices, I'm sorry, December 1968 prices, the Dow Jones index in December 1968 prices would be 366. In other words, since 1968, nearly two-thirds of shareholders' equity has been lost. That's the extent to which stock prices simply have not kept up with inflation or with other types of investments. The recourse by shareholders has been limited. Boards of directors oftentimes represent management, not shareholder interests, as they are supposed to. You typically find lots of inside directors on company boards or directors that one way or another benefit from the company's operations. Boards can dismiss, in many cases, shareholder suits against management. This is something that most stockholders don't realize, and this has happened on a number of occasions. Boards are insured, and who is it that insures these boards against the lawsuit? It's the shareholders again. It's the companies that do the insuring, and it comes out of the returns that shareholders would otherwise make. Investors have typically, in stocks, have typically done the only thing they can. Many of them have voted with their feet and have dropped out of the market. Over the last 10 to 12 to 15 years, they've purchased real estate, gold, and physical assets, particularly when inflation was rampant, and now they're purchasing certificates of deposit, government bonds, and other government securities. The stock market still remains very weak. Now, there are many things with substantial personal benefits to the management, the executives of the company, are primarily responsible, the only thing responsible, not so. But it, I think, is a factor that has caused the problems that we see today, and the fact that that now equity financing for private investment is much less tractable as a means of making investment in productive forms of capital possible in this country. Many things can and should be done to rectify this problem, basically involving the strengthening of the shareholders' position vis-a-vis management, but that's not my concern here. My concern is, how does a good Christian and a good Mormon respond to this type of situation? Increasingly, as many members of our church are faced with becoming successful in the corporate life, increasingly, this problem is going to face these members head on. The theft of shareholder assets, that's the way I would put it, by management. I've used the term corporate communism to describe this because I know of no more effective way to destroy capital than to continue doing what we've been doing with respect to shareholder interests in this country. The theft of shareholder assets is, in my judgment, a very moral issue and one that should be of concern to any good Latter-day Saint. Should a good member of the church succumb to the system? Hopefully the answer is no. We are told that in the latter days, members of the church will be sorely tested. I don't think it's by physical dangers or hard times, but quite to the contrary, I think it's going to be by the very success of the members of the church itself. The saints that were forced to leave their homes and trek across the plains pushing hand carts were, in a real sense, I think, lucky, because they faced hardship and not the temptation that we have in modern corporate life. In 1971, Harold B. Lee made the statement, which was one of the church talks before a conference, that the greatest danger facing the church today is its acceptance by American society. He was truly concerned, as he went on to talk about this danger, with the prospect that many members of the church would succumb to the temptations of American society. And one of these temptations is to abuse positions of corporate trust, which would involve, in effect, using one's position. Harold B. Lee didn't say this, incidentally, I'm saying it. It would be to abuse the positions of corporate trust, which would involve using shareholder assets in a way that would diminish the value of shareholders' equity value. I think Harold B. Lee was correct in his warning, very correct indeed. It would take enormous courage and self-sacrifice for anyone, let alone a member of the church, who approached the top of the corporate ladder to turn down a number of these executive perks which I have described. I think that person would be described or thought of as something of a loon, and probably would be ostracized by other members of the management for doing what he was doing. I can only reiterate what Roy said, which is, when you have to make the tough decisions, do as Christ would do. That is the only sure guide that we have. Despite being in the business world, I've never been able to shake my essential academician's commitment to telling the truth. I gave, as I indicated a moment ago, a trial run of this talk, with a little bit more of a churchy flavor, to the High Priest Corps, in which I teach in our ward, several weeks ago. The result was a veritable explosion in the ward. One person accused me of propagating communist ideas, was his term for it. I had a number of people tell me that I had insulted their companies, that what I had described does not take place in their companies, that on and on and on. The result was that I was spoken to several days later by the quorum leader, who told me he had received a number of complaints that my lesson was not spiritually uplifting. I reminded him that I thought corporate ethics was a spiritually uplifting issue. And now I've been put on notice to mend my ways and not do such things. I feel a little bit like, at times, like poor blind Tiresias, a Roman seer of old who was condemned both to see the truth and to speak it, and then to be punished for it. I thank you very much.
I've observed over the last couple of days what the moderator has done, and it seems in some cases that the moderator has made comments, in other cases he's rebutted, in other cases he's just taken questions. And I'd like to make a couple of comments, a rebut, ask a couple of questions, and then open it up. What I conclude from, if I were just sitting out there in the audience, I think I would conclude that lots of bad stuff goes on out there in business. And I would be reminded a little bit, I think, of the experience that I had, and I would challenge that. I mean, I think that lots of bad stuff does go on. We haven't focused on the corporate proactive ethics that do go on out there, too. I'm reminded at Harvard Business School, they have a brief section of a case where they talk about, or a series of cases where they talk about ethics in business, and it's very, very brief. And the basic conclusion is, when in doubt, maximize profits. But don't deal with the mafia, because in the long run, that won't maximize profits. and basically, the idea is don't do bad stuff. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, and don't abuse company assets. And I think those are the easy, easy parts of ethics as they relate to dealing in a corporation or in a business enterprise. The challenge to me is in a couple of other areas. One is the sort of what I consider to be proactive ethics. How far into the lives of your employees and the people that you deal with do you get? We're doing some things in our company where we're sharing assets with people. That can be a bad thing. It can be a wrong thing to do in somebody's life, to make them better to do than they should be, given their skills and training and everything. It can change their lives fundamentally. We've been doing some things that help people grow. We've taught literature courses and one thing or another to try to get into their lives and expand them. That may or may not be a good thing to do. We have sought, we have meals for all of the employees in our company. We've gotten rid of all the junk food. And now we just serve salads and fruit and things like that. And we've extended that to a no-smoking policy. You know, imposing, in essence, what we believe is good for people on people. Now, the question I'd have is that ethical? Moving further on into that area of proactive ethics would be, do you fire people that aren't performing? Is it ethical to keep people in your organization that aren't performing up to standards? Is that may be bad for them, it may be bad for the people around them not to fire them. So you get in some of these dilemmas. And then I think the toughest area of ethics for me is when you have to choose one virtue over another. It's not do you cheat or do you steal, but when you are faced with the dilemma of choosing one virtue over another. In some cases, truth isn't the ultimate virtue. There may be a virtue higher than telling the absolute truth. In business, there's an accepted practice of sales puffing. Fraud is wrong. Sales puffing is okay. Well, that whole continuum of lying or selectively telling the truth is one that I think you have to deal with. I can think of one example of this that I would pose maybe as the question for these people, and then open it up to everybody. We have a rule in our company that if anybody is involved in any sort of a defalcation, i.e. embezzlement or stealing money or anything, they're booted out and we'll prosecute. Now that is in the interest of everyone who's working there. We believe that that is really in everyone's interest. We had a young woman who was under intense family pressure a couple of years ago steal a fairly minor sum of money with, she said, the intention of paying it back. And the dilemma there for me, talking about ethics, was do we fire her, take her to court, she was a CPA, ruin her career, or do we embrace her back into the organization and tell everybody else in the organization, hey, this kind of thing is winked at, it's okay. Now, those are the tough, tough dilemmas, I think, that you deal with that really stretch. We're talking about Mormon issues in business. That stretches, I think, how close you are to the Spirit and your access to a balance, to making a right choice. And I think, how would you make those kinds of choices in your business? I think that's to me the essence of Mormon concerns in business ethics. I open it up to you or to the floor to ask questions. We started a few minutes late, so we have the right to go a few minutes over, I think. And if anybody wants to leave now, they can feel free to leave. Roy?
I have a couple of thoughts on that. Some of the background reading I crammed in before organizing my thoughts on this included an article by J. Irwin Miller, who is past president of Cummins Engine and was also the first lay president of the Council of Churches. He wrote an article for the Harvard Divinity School Bulletin not too long ago on business ethics. He posed two hypothetical situations that illustrate the point that ethical decisions are not always a case of choosing between right and wrong, and not always between two rights. The first example had to do with a situation where there was an employee in a company that was about ready to retire who was marginally competent at his job, but had been with the company in a long time, had been loyal and never cheated, etc. His immediate subordinate was a young man who had been in his position for 3 or 4 years, if I recall right, and it was time to move him up. He was ambitious, honest, did his job much better than his superior, should be advanced, and if they didn't advance him, the company was going to lose this employee. Now, what should the manager do? Early retire, the fellow had been loyal and wasn't doing a very good job, but nevertheless had the best interests of the company at heart, and hurt that individual so he could advance someone else that's good for the company who also is a good person. You can't win that very well. Molly and I were discussing this, and she had an idea or some thoughts on it that I think are relevant. Sometimes you have to make a hard decision that's going to hurt somebody whichever way you go. If you lay off the individual, the one about to retire, then perhaps the way you do it is what counts. Do you find another job for it? Is it set up in a way that it can be done so he can retire with respect and be a productive member of society afterwards? Or do you find another position in the company for the younger person who can occupy it productively and do other things until he can advance normally? So it isn't necessarily just dealing with the ethical issue, it's how you deal with it and how inventive you are to find a solution around it. The other example he gave had to do with an issue involving bribes. He said, suppose you're the manager of a company who sells parts to companies in foreign countries, and you're responsible for $1 million purchase. Your company has a policy that if you pay a bribe, you're fired. It's that clear cut. There's no ethical issue involved here. If you pay a bribe, you're out. You deliver the shipment to the foreign country, and it's caught up in customs. You're told that if you want it out of customs, you have to pay a bribe. If you pay the bribe, you're fired. If you don't pay the bribe, the shipment is just going to disappear. It's not going to come out of the customs warehouse, and you're not going to see it again. If you go back to your company and tell them that you've lost $1 million shipment, you're going to get fired. Now you're on the horns of a dilemma. Furthermore, you can understand that if your company loses $1 million on this, it's going to be a severe economic blow and people will probably be laid off, which has a consequence for their families. What do you do? He didn't answer the question. I can't give you what he said. What he was arguing for is that companies establish a framework for discussing these kind of ethical decisions prior to their occurring so that a response can be formulated that people understand and that a manager then doesn't get caught in that kind of situation where he feels that I lose either way I go. It's really not that simple, but you have to raise it ahead of time and have an open dialogue if you're going to confront the issue successfully.
I think it would, and I think we do that all the time. And is it ethical to tell a dying person that they're dying if that might kill them? Well, but what I want to point out is there's a whole continuum here, and it isn't just as simple as telling all the truth all the time, complete full disclosure, everything. I think in terms of selling, I think it. My own experience with selling is much more of a negotiating. I think if you're selling to the consumer, in the long run, you're better off, using that profits test, you're better off telling the full truth. And so I think that probably makes sense and is probably a very safe and a wise thing, by all measures, works. I think that in negotiating, there is almost a different set of rules. I negotiate hundreds of millions of dollars worth of contracts at all times, and there is a set of rules in the negotiating game that you hold your cards and the other guy holds his cards and you reveal them piecemeal. He knows what you're holding, you kind of know what he's holding, and it's just a rite. It's almost a ritual that you go through. In some case, I remember initially being taken to task by one of the senior partners of our firm when I came in with the full disclosure approach, thinking I'm going to revolutionize American business. As a return missionary, I am going to fully disclose everything. And so I went in and did that in a major negotiation, and the guy said, don't tell him. He doesn't want to know that. If he knows that, he has some fiduciary responsibilities, and he's lost some of his degrees of freedom to act in the way that is really in the best interest of the deal. And it's a very, very complicated issue. So what you do is you learn kind of the set of rules and what cards you can play, and you play by that set of rules. And I don't think I don't consider that dishonest. Now, maybe 11 years in business has changed my thing.
No, I agree with that general statement. There are times when in business you have to withhold certain information. I'm sure Max Pitcher can't deal with his competition by displaying all of Conoco's discoveries, all its geophysical work, what have you, to its competitors. This is material that is highly secretive, and rightly so. By the same token, Roy Benyon cannot go out and acquire pieces of land and tell the landowner, well, the maximum I'm authorized to pay you is $10 million for this piece of land. He would not be serving his company properly if he could find a seller who'd be willing to take, let's say, $8 million. I do think, though, where it becomes a question of ethics is where you misrepresent the data, where you say to a potential customer, hey, we've got assays that show that there's lots of oil on this land, and when you don't, when in fact it's not potentially productive land, or where you let's say, take a product and misrepresent its effectiveness, possibly in a way that could be injurious to the public. That's where I think ethics would come in, but I don't think a businessman has any compulsion to disclose all the facts in all situations. Now, SEC law does, in fact, require, as a basis of securities law, full disclosure of all relevant facts and information, but where the law requires it, yes, the businessman has an ethical requirement to do it, but I think under all cases, he has an ethical requirement not to falsify the information.